Nagasaki and all those people 75 years ago. A horrified world pushed back against the new technology. And the U.S. sought to find some justifications for continuing to develop nuclear anything and everything. That's when President Dwight Eisenhower addressed the U.N. General Assembly on December 8, 1953, the day after the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack, and introduced the idea of a peaceful atom, one that would transform the horror of the bomb into a benefit for all mankind. Peaceful atom. An oxymoron that sounds like a good idea on the surface, until you hear a genuine expert, a journalist who has been covering nuclear issues for decades, tell you,
importantly, there's no peaceful atom. It's two sides of the same coin. And if, frankly, if our children and their children and future generations are going to make it or to survive, we really have to outlaw nuclear technology, put it back in the bottle, and that can be done.
Well, now that we've all experienced what a lack of peace from that atomic nuclear technology continues to inflict upon the world, both through weapons and reactor technology, you start to get a clearer picture of the nature of that devastating seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Carl Grossman, a veteran journalist who has been covering nuclear issues since before they were rebranded from being called atomic issues. The word atomic having tested poorly in the public mind, you see. Carl shares a vision of a world without nukes, any nukes, peaceful, warlike, or otherwise, with compelling reasons for why this is a path we must follow. We'll also have a new weekly feature on the Radioactive Tokyo 2020 Olympics. Nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than will be included in the U.S. impeachment proceedings. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 21st, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off here in the U.S. in California, just down the road from me, where at the Santa Susana Field Lab, California's Department of Toxic Substances Control is opposing a revised NASA cleanup plan to remove a limited amount of contamination from the former rocket and energy research site. This is where a partial meltdown of a nuclear reactor, a test nuclear reactor, happened decades ago. DTSC, the agency, has called NASA's proposal irregular, infeasible, and legally deficient. Santa Susana Field Lab is only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles, and it's a site where 17,000 rocket engine tests occurred. It was also home to 10 nuclear reactors, and the site experienced a partial nuclear meltdown in an unenclosed and uncontained building in 1959, which it managed to cover up for 20 years until students from UCLA uncovered the evidence. In 2010, NASA agreed to a consent order requiring soil remediation of the site, which was contaminated with 16 different radiologicals, like cesium-137, as well as 116 chemicals. And NASA agreed to have the cleanup completed as of 2017. The California agency said that it is not open to considering NASA's cleanup alternatives, which are non-compliant with the original administrative order on consent. Full cleanup of the site is supported by the Los Angeles chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Committee to Bridge the Gap, and the Santa Susana Field Lab Work Group, consisting largely of parents who live in the area and whose children have been diagnosed with cancer. In Buchanan, New York, site of the now-shuttered Indian Point nuclear reactors, Holtec, the company that seems to be tasked with tearing down the facility, faced its first public meeting and some tough questions from the audience. Holtec estimates that the job will cost $2.3 billion. But at the end of October, a decommissioning trust fund set aside for the day when Indian Point would be shut down had just $2.1 billion. This is comparable to Massachusetts, where Holtec plans to tear down the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, an action that is being opposed or at least challenged by large numbers of groups. And people there have voiced concerns that the company could walk away from the job after bleeding money from the trust fund and leaving ratepayers on the hook. Even more troubling comes this report from longtime Nuclear Hot Seat listener Courtney Williams, who is a cancer researcher. She attended the meeting and said that Holtec didn't even know there were gas pipelines under the plant, despite the fact that New York State had done a risk assessment that said the gas would need to be shut off during decommissioning due to increased risks from demolition. She also noted that Holtec sent a rep who didn't know the answers to any of the questions put forward by the community, lied by omission, and when pressed, threw up his hands and said, "I've only worked here 6 months." Yeah, try and tell me this augurs well for the future. Over to Japan, where Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, admits that coolant has seeped out from an underground frozen soil wall. Now they're calling it a soil wall instead of an ice wall. Built around the site of the triple meltdown Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility. It's meant to keep groundwater from flowing into reactor buildings, but has rarely worked without problems in the 4 years it's been up. No word on what this leak may have done to radiation levels. Now, for an update on the radioactive Tokyo 2020 Olympics. Yes, the radioactive Tokyo 2020 Olympics now has its own nuclear hot seat theme. Each week, we will highlight another aspect of these games that makes absolutely no sense in the sane world. This week, the town of Futaba, which is in the radiation exclusion zone and has just been added to the stops on the Olympics torch relay. The run already starts in J Village, only 12 miles from the still highly radioactive Fukushima Daiichi triple meltdown site. But then it comes even closer to those still highly radioactive reactors. To learn what this means, we spoke with Nuclear Hot Seat's Voices from Japan co-producer, Beverly Findlay Kaneko. Here's just a brief excerpt from our much longer talk. Where is the town of Futaba, and what is its significance regarding the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant?
Futaba is actually the town that hosted the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in conjunction with the town of Okuma. It is north and sort of surrounding the whole accident site.
How close is Fukushima Daiichi to the town?
It's in the town.
You were in Fukushima Prefecture on the ground for 4 days last October, and we featured a very thorough report from you in Nuclear Hot Seats number 439 and 440. During that time, you chose not to go to Futaba. Why was that?
Well, it wasn't a choice not to go to Futaba. We couldn't go to Futaba because it is in the exclusion zone. We're not allowed to go to Futaba.
In other words, it's off limits. It's the, difficult to return zone, which is the equivalent of the exclusion zone at Chernobyl?
Exactly.
There is a lot more that Beverly shared about what is wrong with having the Olympic torch run go through Futaba and what it is meant to cover up within Japan. And we will have that fuller information for you next week on Nuclear Hot Seat number 449. And if this wasn't bad enough,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nom Nuts of the Week.
Japanese supermarket chain Aeon Company Limited, Asia's biggest retailer by sales, aims to start selling eco-certified sushi this year, just in time for an expected surge in tourists during the radioactive Tokyo Olympics. Japan has lagged behind Europe and the United States in adopting policies on traceability and sustainability fisheries, but said nothing about testing for radioactivity. Kurasushi President Kunihiko Tanaka also defended the safety of the seafood in Japan, including those from Fukushima, site of the 2011 nuclear disaster, proudly claiming that Kurasushi planned to open a restaurant in Fukushima. Meanwhile, South Korea, one of six countries that refuses to touch anything that comes out of the ocean near Fukushima, has its Olympics committee planning to buy radiation detectors and ship homegrown ingredients to Japan for its athletes during the Olympics because of concerns over radiation in the food. You may want to believe and push the belief that everything is A-OK with seafood from Japan, but let's just get that clock ticking, counting down to what people's health is going to be, and let's track it. Anybody who eats sushi, let alone sushi in Japan, including fish from Fukushima, perhaps eaten in Fukushima, let's find out what your health is like in 3, 5, 10, 15, 20 and more years from now. And whether you're going to look back at that meal and go, gee, that was not particularly smart. And that's why Kurasushi and Aeon Company Limited, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nom Nuts of the Week.
Moving on to international news, last week on Nuclear Hot Seat, we covered the story of how a mistaken cell phone text warned millions of Canadians in Ontario of a non-existent incident at a nuclear plant near Toronto. The warning was about an incident that wasn't an incident, but perhaps was an incident, at the Pickering Nuclear Generating Station, an 8-reactor complex in the middle of Toronto. They're now saying it was most likely a mishap during a routine test of the province's alert system during a shift change. But it raises questions about why it took the government almost 2 hours to correct its mistake with another cell phone alert. A call is being made for an independent public investigation into the incident and why it took so long to correct that error. Greenpeace Canada's program director, Sean Patrick Stencil, said he's concerned the provincial government does not have the capacity and expertise to run nuclear emergency preparedness. He said, a shift change. If they can't pull that off, imagine what would happen in the event of a real nuclear emergency. This false alarm did serve to alert the local area that they have nuclear reactors in their midst, a fact that many were totally unaware of, and calls for potassium iodide pills, which are given away free to local residents, have risen to more than 32,000 in the days initially after this incident. Online ordering and mailing of KI pills is currently closed for winter months because of the temperature sensitivity of potassium iodide pills, and so special pickup places have been scheduled for a full week. And Ontario Premier Doug Ford, never one to lose an opportunity to do the wrong thing, the day after the false alarm, announced his intention of keeping the aging nuclear reactors at Pickering online, something his critics have called playing with fire. The first of the reactors on this site was opened in 1971, and Ford wants to run them past their already extended deadline of 2024. Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition of Nuclear Responsibility and a scientist says, as it gets older, the metal used in nuclear reactors gets progressively more brittle, meaning it is more inclined to break, more inclined to crack, more inclined to split, and that is very dangerous. We'll link to this article, which has a lot of great information in it, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 448. And not surprisingly, in a national poll administered in Canada to over 2,000 Canadians,
Friends of the Earth Canada found that most do not trust nuclear energy or reactors.
Can you blame them?
In the UK, a worrying new report has found that Cumbria, in northwest England, the beautiful Lake District, has the highest incidence rates of certain kind of cancer in the northwest. 11% higher on key cancers than the national average. On the coast of Cumbria is Sellafield, Europe's largest nuclear site. As long ago as 1993, the area showed that the incidence of leukemia and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was 14 times the national average. And in a bit of good news, the European Union's European Green Deal, intended to make the bloc climate neutral by 2050, has excluded nuclear energy from the Just Transition Mechanism, a key component of the European Green Deal. However, in order to convince Hungary and the Czech Republic to sign up, they also reaffirmed the rights of countries to decide on their own energy mix, including nuclear. Still, it's an excellent start. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, I wanted to bring you up to date on the website revamp. I know I announced it as being in process last December, which was a little bit premature because it hit some bumps in the road with the first service providers I was about to hire. And after taking a long time trying to iron out the problems, I had to start looking for someone else. Fortunately, before any money exchanged hands. The good news is that I finally located someone whose work I trust, and all things being equal, she will be able to get started on the revamp as of next week. A new look for the website, expanded searchability, and a lot of invisible infrastructure you don't need to know about that will put my mind at rest and set up the show for the next however many years we've got. Now, as I've shared with you before, the only thing that keeps Nuclear Hot Seat going is the support of listeners like you. And the website redo is, as you might expect, taking a big bite out of our limited finances. So now would be a perfect time for you to make that donation you've been thinking of giving. It will go to support not only the website makeover, but the show itself. The one place that you can count on every week to deliver a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information. Interviews with genuine experts who are critical of the industry and technology. A roundup of international nuclear news, never enough time for all the stories that deserve it. Numbnuts of the Week, now a weekly Radioactive Tokyo 2020 Olympics story. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry lies? So if you want to stop nukes and help get the word out, help us with a donation. We make it easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send a donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5 donation, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S., just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please, do what you can now. And know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. According to Wikipedia, Carl Grossman is an author and journalism professor at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He hosts the TV program Enviro Close-Up, is the author of 6 books, and writer of numerous magazine, newspaper, and internet articles. But that doesn't even come close to describing the full range of Carl's talents, abilities, and accomplishments. Carl Grossman has been covering nuclear issues for over 50 years, and in terms of knowing how things came about and where the bodies are buried, that's a metaphor, we hope, nobody does it better. He has been an important early and consistent supporter of my work with Nuclear Hot Seat, and we talk with him here about the need to make Earth a nuclear-free zone. I talked with Carl Grossman on January 12, 2020.
Carl Grossman, it's always a joy to have you with us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
A pleasure to be with you, Libby, even though the subject is rather appalling.
Carl, you have often written and spoken on the idea that the only realistic way to secure a future for the world without nuclear war is for the entire planet to become a nuclear-free zone. What do you mean by that?
Well, the United Nations, back in 1975, designated major parts of the Earth the entireties of Africa and South America, the South Pacific, as nuclear-free zones where there would not be nuclear weapons. What I think needs to be done is that the entire planet has to be declared a nuclear-free zone, but importantly, not just, just isn't a strong enough word here, not just nuclear weapons, but nuclear power as well, because the horrific threat of nuclear war comes to us from this double-sided nuclear weapons and nuclear power, because any country with a reactor, with a nuclear reactor, has the, well, the trained personnel and the material, the plutonium that nuclear reactors produce to have an atomic weapon. Indeed, India got the bomb in 1974. How? Canada supplied a reactor to India for, quote, peaceful purposes, and the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission trained Indian engineers, and lo and behold, India had nuclear weapons. So this, importantly, there's no peaceful atom. It's two sides of the same coin. And if, frankly, if our children and their children and future generations are going to make it or to survive, we really have to outlaw nuclear technology, put it back in the bottle, and that can be done.
When you say that can be done, putting the genie back in the bottle is one of those things that people think is not possible with nuclear, that we've crossed a line. Is there a precedent for taking a dangerous technology and dialing it back so that the danger does not exist anymore?
Yeah, there's a clear precedent, and that was the outlawing of poison gas, of chemical warfare, and that came after World War I and the horrific impacts of the use of chlorine gas and mustard gas. I mean, they killed thousands and thousands of soldiers on both sides of the conflict. So after World War I, people realized that, you know, chemical warfare is outrageous. It's horrific. It must be outlawed. And there was the Geneva Protocol of 1925 and the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1933. And they outlawed chemical warfare. And to a large degree, not 100%, but to a large degree, that prohibition has held. And I feel that before we have a nuclear war, though Hiroshima and Nagasaki should have given us a pretty good idea about what nuclear weapons can do, we must outlaw nuclear weaponry. And as I say, importantly too, is to outlaw nuclear power at the same time. I mean, a person who understood this, ironically, was the person who is considered the father of the U.S. nuclear navy, Admiral Hyman Rickover. He also was in charge of the construction of the first nuclear power plant in the United States, shipping port in Pennsylvania. And somehow he must have had an epiphany. And after decades of being this big booster of nuclear technology, he retired from the Navy and he made a speech. In fact, you can read the speech online to a congressional committee in which he said that a few billion years ago, it was impossible to have any life on Earth. There was so much radiation on Earth, you couldn't have any life. Then gradually the amount of radiation on this planet, I'm quoting Rick over here, not Greenpeace, and probably in the entire system reduced and made it possible for some form of life to begin. And he went on, by utilizing nuclear power, we are creating something which nature tried to destroy to make life possible. Every time you produce radiation, a horrible force is unleashed. He's talking here about the fission products produced by the breaking apart of the atom, the splitting of the atom. And in some cases, Rickover went on, these horrid fission products, these are a return of the very poisons that existed billions of years ago, which prohibited life from existing on Earth. In some cases, they'll be around for billions of years. And there, says Rickover, I think the human race is going to wreck itself. And not to be too anthropomorphic, It ain't just people. It's life on Earth. I mean, they say cockroaches are capable of absorbing hundreds of times the radioactivity that a human being can absorb. But I don't know if we want cockroaches to inherit the Earth. And then he goes on, well, he talks about having an international meeting first to outlaw nuclear weapons, and then we outlaw, this is Rickover, nuclear reactors too. And he says, in terms of nuclear weapons, and the guy was an admiral, it was an Annapolis graduate, the lesson of history is when a war starts, every nation will ultimately use whatever weapon has been available. That is the lesson learned time and again. Therefore, we must expect if another war, a serious war, breaks out, we will use nuclear energy in some form. And again, quoting Rickover, we will probably destroy ourselves. I mean, the fact is, the reality is that nuclear war is not winnable. This whole notion that we've lived through for decades of mutually assured destruction, that we have this huge nuclear arsenal, thousands of weapons, the Russians have thousands of weapons, and if there's an exchange, we destroy each other. And that somehow was thought to block nuclear war. Frankly, ever since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, ever since the creation of atomic weaponry, by the skin of our teeth, by the skin of our teeth, we have made it. There have been a number of, accidents which could have kicked in a nuclear war. Now with this Trump administration, you have a president, this Trump, who's open to the use of nuclear weaponry. He said, we have them. Why don't we use them? A few months ago, he was talking about Afghanistan, and he was saying, well, if we want to take out Afghanistan, in a couple of weeks, I could kill 10 million people. I mean, how was he going to kill 10 million people in a couple of weeks? It would be nuclear weaponry. So we have a situation now which has put the doomsday clock, not to sound too apocalyptic, but that's what we're dealing with. Just a few minutes from midnight, it's as bad as it's ever been. And I believe we have to, I mean, some people might think this is impractical. Some people might think it's too radical that we can't put the genie back in the bottle. But I think that the wrong things people have done can be undone when it's understood that it was so wrong, and in the case of nuclear technology, so dangerous and so awful. We've been trying, we've kind of succeeded, but it ain't going to last too long with a carrot and stick approach, by rewarding certain nations if they don't pursue nuclear weaponry. We provide them with a carrot, and then meanwhile there'll be a stick if you go towards nuclear weaponry. But at the same time, we have embraced this myth, this big chunk of baloney about the peaceful atom. There's no peaceful atom. Any country with a nuclear plant, as I say, with a reactor, because reactors in the process of fission produce, in fact, they produce hundreds of pounds of plutonium a year as a byproduct of fission. The Nagasaki bomb, incidentally, had but 20 pounds of plutonium. So whether it's a nuclear power plant, which the Trump administration wants to see built, in fact, a bunch of them in Saudi Arabia, or whether it's nuclear, I just saw a piece about Uganda moving ahead to develop nuclear power plants with Russian support. Any country which has a nuclear power plant, a nuclear reactor, has the trained personnel, like those Indian engineers who were trained by our then Atomic Energy Commission, and the materiel, the plutonium, to build a nuclear weapon. So there's no atoms for peace. Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, made a speech at the United Nations in 1953, which kicked off this Atoms for Peace baloney program that, okay, we don't like nuclear war, but atoms for peace. Again, it's two sides of the same coin. So back to what I was saying, that the only, frankly, practical way, And I don't believe it's radical. I think it's what we need is for the planet, the whole planet. We have to work for this. It's not going to happen tomorrow or next week. But we got to work and work hard on this to abolish nuclear weaponry, and at the same time, abolish nuclear power, nuclear technology, and to survive and to live.
I'm in complete agreement with you on this. The nuclear industry is putting a lot of money and a PR push and talking points into its newest technology, small modular nuclear reactors, as though they are somehow different, somehow cleaner, safer, and that they are going to be the saviors of the climate crisis. In your estimation, how accurate or honest is that claim? And would this new technology, the small modular nuclear reactors, have the same profile in terms of, as it's been said, having a bomb in the basement, having in its waste stream the plutonium that could then be utilized as a bomb?
Yeah, well, the small modular reactors, all these, the new improved nukes of one sort or another, they all produce enormous amounts of nuclear waste. They're all subject to accidents. They all involve, and Rickover, he used the word which is central here, radioactivity. I mean, it's like what was during the Clinton campaign, that slogan, a new version of it would be, it's not the economy stupid, it's radioactivity stupid. It's the radioactivity produced by this machine. As Rickover says, we must outlaw nuclear reactors, nuclear power plants. And to add to that, these folks in the nuclear establishment, and it's the nuclear industry, it's Westinghouse and General Electric, and it's these huge national nuclear laboratories like Los Alamos and Oak Ridge, and essentially got their start during the Manhattan Project to build atomic weapons during World War II. They were so scared that the Nazis were going to build atomic bombs because fission had been done in late 38 in Germany. So it was a notion of fighting fire with fire. And so there's this huge establishment, a nuclear establishment employing hundreds of thousands, billions was spent. At the end of the war, you had created a vested interest. How are these folks going to keep their jobs? How are General Electric and Westinghouse, which became the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power, 80% of nuclear plants worldwide are of GE manufacture or design. I mean, we can build more nuclear weapons. And under Edward Teller, the super was built. In fact, he got his own national laboratory, Lawrence Livermore, to build the hydrogen bomb. You can't sell an atomic bomb or a hydrogen bomb, even to an ally, to France or to England. What can be done with nuclear technology to perpetuate this establishment? And they thought of nuclear-powered airplanes, nuclear-powered rockets, food irradiation to zap potatoes. You can eat a potato or strawberry 20 years after they'd be picked. And then it was nuclear power plants. It's the most dangerous way to boil water ever conceived, using fission. So there was this nuclear establishment created out of the Manhattan Project, and they've lied like they've breathed. These nuclear Pinocchios, through the years, it's been one claim after it. I remember when shipping port was first opened, this is back in 57, Louis Strauss, who was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, said that nuclear power would be electricity too cheap to meter. That's not so. There's only two nuclear plants, thankfully, being built. There were supposed to be many at this time in the United States. Each one is to cost, down in Georgia, $13.5 billion. Where I live on Long Island in New York, the Shoreham nuclear plant, in a book I wrote about Shoreham and the other almost a dozen nuclear power plants that the Long Island Lighting Company wanted to build on Long Island. It wanted to create a nuclear park out of Long Island. As a facsimile, I print the original press release from 1966 for Shoreham. And Lilko says it will be in the 65 to 75 $1 million range. Well, it turns out it was stopped, $6.5 to $7.5 billion range. Grassroots opposition and governmental opposition stopped Shoreham. It was completed, it was constructed, was stopped from going into commercial operation. And the other was 7 to 11 nuclear plants planned for Long Island were prevented from being constructed, from being built. And then there was two nuclear reactors at Brookhaven National Laboratory. It was the laboratory set up by the folks at the Manhattan Project that would focus on civilian uses of nuclear technology, very, very tied actually to the Long Island nuclear push when the Shoreham Project first began. It's not just the nuclear industry, it's also the nuclear establishment within government. And they've lied and they've lied and they've lied to promote their nuclear establishment for jobs and for, as I know, Westinghouse and GE wanted to keep busy with contracts and so forth and with nuclear work. So when it comes to the small modular reactors or any of this other baloney that the nuclear establishment wants to throw at us, it's tobacco science. It's tobacco industry science. It's full of falsehoods. It's all not true. And the problem here is that, like cigarettes, it's gonna kill and it does kill. You look at any nuclear plant anywhere in the world and the allowed emissions, the permissible radiation emissions, and all nuclear plants emit radioactivity, cause cancer clusters around. I'm on the board of the Radiation and Public Health Project. People could perhaps look up their website, Radiation and Public Health Project. It's a deadly and unnecessary, totally unnecessary technology. I mean, particularly these days. I wrote my first book on nuclear back in 1980. I began it the day of the Three Mile Island accident because, just a quick story, I had gone a couple of years before to Brookhaven National Laboratory. I had a television show on the PBS station on Long Island. They asked me to do something on nuclear. I went to Brookhaven Lab for some nuclear proponents, which is essentially all of them at Brookhaven Lab. In fact, they call themselves Nukies, these nuclear physicists at Brookhaven National Laboratory, Nukies. I put my microphone in front of their faces and they said to the camera, well, maybe every couple of hundred years, there might be a minor accident, but there's so much redundancy in these machines, you're not going to have a serious accident. And then I try to balance it out. This was not, frankly, good investigative reporting. It was ping pong journalism. But at that point, I didn't know enough about nuclear power to, when these people started to lie into the camera, say, hey, come on. And in fact, I started that book, Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, the day I got the news that Three Mile Island was undergoing a meltdown. And I was thinking of those scientists and how they try to bamboozle me and my viewers. Still get copies of the book, and it's full of facsimiles. I figured it'd be better to, this is before desktop publishing, using a scissor, cutting out pieces of documents and reprinting the documents. For example, I mean, some people might say, maybe those Brookhaven scientists didn't know the dangers. There's pages and pages from the WASH 740 update. It's a report done at Brookhaven National Laboratory in the 60s about the consequences of a major nuclear plant accident. And over, many hundreds of times in WASH 740 update, and it's in the book, I cut it out, there it is. It says a big accident could impact an area the size of the state of Pennsylvania. The odds of a catastrophic accident, not good either. And in terms of, again, people haven't been given this information. In the beginning of the book, for example, and perhaps most listeners now don't know, that in the United States, because of something called the Price-Anderson Act, which was passed by Congress in 1957, limiting liability in the event of a major nuclear plant accident to $560 million, with the government paying the first $500 million, the utility, they would pay about $60 million, even though the consequences could be in the billions and billions of dollars. But if you look at your homeowner's insurance, and I suggest that listeners do, look at the nuclear clause. It's in everybody's homeowner's insurance in the United States. And it says that this policy doesn't cover loss or damage caused by radioactivity, by radiation, and so forth. And what I did was I cut out, it was from my Allstate policy. I might be in good hands with Allstate if I had an accident with my car. But if there would be a nuclear plant accident at, for example, where I live on Eastern Long Island, at Millstone, which is right across Long Island Sound in Connecticut, or at Salem or in Oyster Creek down the Atlantic in New Jersey, I would not be in good hands with Allstate. And as I cut it out, printed it in cover up what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power. And that was published in 1980, and it's been, that's 40 years. And as I've given presentations through this 40-year period, I use as a slide this nuclear clause. And actually, I print a couple of, not just Allstate. I also print another insurance company's, CNA's, nuclear clause. And as I've presented that to groups, when people have read my book, they said, we didn't know. The book Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power begins with, you have not been told, you've not been informed, and that has been done on purpose. And that's why I called the book Cover Up. As to the tie-in between nuclear power and nuclear war, that's so important for people to understand that many people, and a surprising grouping of people, are against nuclear weaponry. For example, George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State, he's been involved in the Hoover Institute. And here is an essay by George Shultz. Nuclear weapons were and are the gravest threat to humanity's survival. Shultz, a very middle-of-the-road Republican, a very establishment figure, says their effect in preventing wars has been overrated, and reports of the damage they cause tend to be brushed aside. Great. And there's bunches of organizations that have been attempting to abolish, including Abolition 2000, excellent organization, to eliminate, to abolish nuclear weapons. But I say that's not enough, because any country with a nuclear reactor, with a nuclear power plant, could follow the example of India and from a nuclear power plant then have nuclear weapons. And these days, what they call proliferation, and mostly the focus has been on the proliferation of nuclear weaponry, it's not enough. It has to be the proliferation of nuclear technology, period. And that, like chemical warfare, must be stopped, must be ended. And folks might say that you can't put the genie back in the bottle, that's too radical. I think this notion of continuing to try to use a carrot and a stick ain't going to last very long. It may not last a generation. It's our children, their children, their children. They're not going to make it if we allow nuclear technology to continue to proliferate on this planet, this deadly technology, which precluded life, as Rickover said, which precluded life from existing billions of years ago. It will again, if there's a full-fledged, with Russia, the U.S. on hair trigger alert, the U.S. has what we call a triad, submarines with nuclear weaponry and multiple warheads that absolutely dwarf what the atomic bombs that were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were about. We have these ICBMs. I mean, right now, as we speak, there are soldiers in silos, mostly in the Dakotas in the United States, sitting there ready to push the button on the order of, God help us, Donald Trump. You have B-52 nuclear-capable bombers and the B-1 nuclear-capable bomber. I mean, what did Trump just send to when this issue began with...
With Iran. Six nuclear-capable B-52s have been sent to an island in the Indian Ocean that is within striking distance for us of Iran, but Iran does not have the weaponry to be able to take out those bombers. So it's part of the preparation, the saber rattling, the positioning, the posturing, whatever you want to call it, that is, again, ramping us up. And I believe as a sexual predator will groom a potential victim, this is part of grooming the United States and indeed the world to expect that there's going to be the use of a nuclear weapon because, as has been said by this administration, if we've got them, why don't we use them? Which brings me to this question, Carl. With all of this danger out there, and you've articulated it wonderfully well. What can be done to create the pressure from the ground up to stop this march towards seemingly inevitable nuclear weapons use and begin the process of creating the Earth as a nuclear-free zone?
It's always best to do it as a group, to organize. Organize, organize, and organize, as the famed labor leader once said. So the groups, I mentioned Abolition 2000, there's many others. I'm also on the board of a group called Beyond Nuclear, which is a terrific group, and it's based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. It's for the outlawing of nuclear power plants. It's against nuclear power, particularly, again, with these plentiful alternatives, solar and wind. And I mean, we don't need nuclear power, period. And it's against, too, this notion of nuclear war, against nuclear weapons. It's for the abolition of nuclear weapons. We must go beyond nuclear. We must end this dead-end road that the world has been put on with nuclear. And I would recommend, again, doing it in a group at the grassroots is so important. And I'd recommend folks should go to the website of Beyond Nuclear. It's beyondnuclear.org. And you'll see their programs, their activities. Join up. Find people in political places, and there's not that many, who understand nuclear power and we must abolish nuclear weapon. I mean, Obama made a start at it. Obama made a very famous speech when he first took us, a few weeks after he took office, declaring a commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. Problem is, it didn't take too long for Barack Obama to be pushing a modernization of the U.S.'s nuclear arsenal. Why do we need modernization? So we kill 20 million instead of 16. I mean, and in terms of nuclear power, he started talking about clean nuclear power. That's an oxymoron, ain't so? So we got to watch out who we support, who we endorse politically. But there are some people in government, politics, who understand the relationship between nuclear power and nuclear war and join up and support them.
There's also the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANW.org,
yes,
which is located in Scandinavia and won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017 for its work against nuclear weapons. And I would strongly urge people to go to ICANW.org to check out their work as well. There are two corollaries to that. There is don'tbankonthebomb.com, which is a highly effective international campaign for removing money, including pension funds and all kinds of financial investments, from those companies that manufacture nuclear weapons. And the corollary of that here in the United States is backfromthebrink.org. These are all programs that are working actively to move us away from nuclear war, that are structured in such a way that grassroots individuals, anyone, can get involved and put their energy, their money, I don't care if it's 27 cents, but it gives you the right to talk with your bank manager and say, I don't want my money invested in anything that supports nuclear weapons. Where is the money of this bank invested? And then put your pressure there. It can be from you. It can be from your pension fund. It can be from an investment fund. Talk to your financial advisors. I mean, there are a number of ways that we can do it. There are actually a number of programs that are attempting to do it. And we must do what we can as fast as we can, because there is a drumbeat trying to normalize the concept of nuclear war to a populace that doesn't understand the full consequences of what that can do. And we need to do everything in our power to not let that happen. Because, as I like to say, it's not a matter of, oh, it'll happen on the other side of the planet. Earth is a rock in the middle of a bubble of environment. in the middle of nowhere. What happens on Earth stays on Earth, and it gets recirculated around, and it will smack us upside the head, as it already has been, from nuclear weapons that have been exploded in the environment. That the radiation is there. The radiation is the lingering danger. And the fact that people don't understand what that is and how both nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors put us in the danger of exposure to radiation, I think, is the key factor in why people are not more alarmed about nukes and think that it's just a matter of, oh, it's a bigger bang for the buck, and so why can't we use it?
At this point, it's critical. For so many years, by the skin of our teeth, we avoid nuclear destruction, just by the skin of our teeth. And there were accidents that could have so easily propelled us. I mean, I remember as a kid growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and we did duck and cover. For so many years, we lived under this nuclear cloud. And frankly, we're there again. There was a report a couple of years ago. This is when Trump first took office, of a defense science board. You could see this report. It's online. Federation of American Scientists and others have put this online. And in it, they talk about the need for a more flexible nuclear enterprise that could produce a rapid tailored nuclear option. They're talking here weapons for limited use. Such thing as limited use of nuclear weapons. But that was what was envisioned way back in the 50s. And we're now so many decades away, and we've done this full throttle reversal. We have a person in Trump who is all for normalizing and considering the feasibility of nuclear weaponry.
Carol, this has been wide-ranging. You've certainly been covering this subject matter for decades now, and you know where a lot of the bodies are buried. Thank you for the work you've done, the vigilance you've had, your perspective. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great to be with you.
Carol Grossman, journalist and Eminal Scries, great gray eminence of the anti-nuclear movement. We'll have a link up to Carol's terrific book, Cover Up, What You Are Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. And it will be on the website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 448.
Activists, shout out.
Yeah, I've been playing around with sound engineer Craig Parker Adams of Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood again, in case you couldn't tell. First off, congratulations to Norbert G. Suchinek, writer-director, and Marcia Gomez de Oliveira, producer of the film Cheese Instead of Uranium. With it, that would work in nuclear reactors too. But it's a film about the people of the town of Nisa, a medieval village in Portugal, where they have decided to leave uranium in the ground in favor of sustainable development based on the region's natural products, such as beef, goat, and sheep, milk, cheese, sausages, hams, and olives. The film has just been announced as an official selection of the Lazio Film Festival, and we wish them every luck with it. Norbert and Marcia are best known for operating the International Uranium Film Festival, which you hear about regularly here on Nuclear Hot Seat. If you can get yourself to Paris on February 14 and 15, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons Paris Forum is going to be held on how to ban bombs and influence people. It will focus on strategizing ways to solve big problems like climate change, discrimination, and nuclear weapons, and how to turn that into political action and results in your community, your country, or on a global scale. Speakers will include Setsko Thurlow, Hiroshima bomb survivor, ICAN campaigner, and iconic voice in the push to achieve the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and Smriti Keshari, an award-winning Indian-American director and artist whose work includes the stunning multimedia installation, The Bomb. To find out more, go to the website paris.icanw.org. Savannah Riverside Watch is holding a program on the proposed plutonium bomb plant at the Savannah River site. It will be held on January 27, that's next Monday, and is sponsored by the John Bachman Group in Columbia, South Carolina, of the Sierra Club. Get further information from the website srswatch.org. And here in Los Angeles, plans are already underway for the start of commemorative events for the 9th anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear triple meltdown. On Saturday, March 14, from 2 to 4:30 p.m., there will be a panel discussion and networking opportunity to discuss the 2020 Tokyo so-called Recovery Olympics. It's hosted by Pacific Asian Nuclear Free Peace Alliance, being produced by Tsukuru Fours, and I'm pleased to be the moderator for the panel discussion, which will include fireside chats, including Hiroko Ayahara, Beverly Finlay Kaneko, and others. We'll have contact information for all of these up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 448. Here's today's final thought. We've just passed the anniversary of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King, and in his spirit, we offer his word. While addressing the War Resisters League in 1959, he said, "Not only in the South, but throughout the nation and the world, we live in an age of conflicts, an age of biological weapons, chemical warfare, atomic fallout, and nuclear bombs. Every man, woman, and child lives, not knowing if they shall see tomorrow's sunrise. What will be the ultimate value of having established social justice in a context where all people are merely free to face destruction by strontium-90 or atomic war?" Good question. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 21st, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, LOHUD.org, BloombergEnvironment.com, NHK.OR.JP, InsideTheGames.biz, US.BlastingNews.com, Korea Joongang Daily, TheGlobeAndMail.com, Windsor.CTVNews.ca, NationalObserver.com, Friends of the Earth Canada, NWQMail.co.uk, Euractiv.com, and all the outreach email and Facebook messages I receive from you, activists around the world. Keep them coming. A reminder that Nuclear Hot Seat is now available on all your favorite podcast platforms. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe! And if there's a platform we've missed, let us know and we'll load it up there as well. Thanks to all of you for listening and joining with Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. Now, if you want to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, fill it in with your first name and email address, and we will send you one weekly email with a link to the show and a short summary of what's in it. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We will really be grateful for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby Halevi and Hartestree Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestree Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that exposure to radioactivity is cumulative throughout your life, and there is no such thing as a harmless dose. It all counts. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So please, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.